sunshine.
Okay, gentlemen.
Oh, the first.
We'll get started.
Okay.
So if you can open up to your Gemara, for those who came, it's on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph, and we're up to Tanya. Now, I can try to give you a little bit of a shortcut how to find the word Tanya on the page. You'll see on the left side of your page a Tosfos, which starts the Onim. And if you draw a straight line across, you'll see the word Tanya. Now, we're not learning Lubavitch tonight, but if we were, Tanya is a very big name in Lubavitch. And that's the most famous work of the founder of Lubavitch, what we call the Alter Rebbe. But the reason why the book Tanya opens up with the word Tanya is because he starts the book with a Braisa. And we've mentioned on numerous occasions that a Braisa is Tanaitic literature from Tanoim. It's the same period of time as the Mishnah, but the Mishnah is not all-inclusive. There are many, many statements that were left out of the Mishnah for various reasons. Again, in every case, it's going to be a different reason as to why it was left out of the Mishnah. But Tanya means a Braisa. Braisa, something that was left out of the Mishnah. And in this case, probably for the next hour, we're going to try to figure out what went on in the story told by this Braisa. Now, just to give you a little bit of frame of reference, the last thing that we discussed, which was just a week ago this evening, was a discussion about Mishmarot. Mishmarot means that the night is divided into three segments. Each segment is called a Mishmar, otherwise known as a watch in English, or a segment of time. So for example, if the night is 12 hours long, how many hours is in each Mishmarot if there are three Mishmarot?
Three.
How did you get three? If they're 12 hours.
Four.
I know you're better at math than I am, but this I remember from my younger days.
Yeah.
That if you take 12 and you divide into three, each section is four. So Zach, you're with me on that? So each section has 4 hours. Now,
I was thinking a shorter night.
Yeah. Now that the night is broken up into three sections of 4 hours each, you may recall that during each one of these sections, there's what's called the Shagat Aryeh. There's the roar of the lion. That lion is a symbolic representation of Almighty God. And he is crying out like a lion who's in pain over the fact that his house, his palace, with a capital H, his house was destroyed. So in that sense, what we're learning now about the destruction of the temple is somewhat relevant to the time period that we're going into, because before you know it, we'll be up to the 3 weeks, starting with the 17th of Tammuz, culminating in the 9th of Av, when the Migdash was destroyed. So this is, you know, now that we have Shavuos behind us, we have all the holidays behind us, we're entering into a little bit more of a sad period of time. Doesn't mean you have to walk around depressed, or maybe that's what it means, but in any way, it's a period of mourning. So don't get confused between mourning and night over here, because we're talking about the nighttime. Okay, that was a bad pun. Mourning is M-O-U-R, not M-O-R-N. So we're talking about the grief up in Shamayim, up in the heavens, over the destruction of the temple. And you'll see soon how that ties into the story of Rabbi Yossi. Omar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi tells us the following story. Pam Achas. Now, for those of you who know Hebrew, you have a great advantage here, because a lot of this Gemara that we're learning is actually in Lashon Kodesh, in the Holy Tongue. So if you know Hebrew, you're really at a great, great advantage. And even in modern Israeli Hebrew, we speak about pam achat, on one occasion. So pam means on an occasion, achat on one occasion. So Rabbi Yossi is telling us a story probably that happened only once in his lifetime. Otherwise, he wouldn't have introduced it by saying pam achat. Apparently, this was an incident in his life that was forever engraved in his memory. So, pam achat, hayiti mahalech baderech. I was walking on the road. Everybody see that? Mahalech means to walk. Baderech is on the road. Now, classically, in a classic sense, the word derech, the word road, indicates a certain volume of crowd, of being crowded, if you follow what I mean. You know, the road is usually where people walk, and people go with their carts and their wagons, and it's a very crowded area. And we're going to soon see that Rabbi Yossi was looking for a place to pray. In the middle of the road, that's not conducive for prayer, because you'll be distracted by the masses of people, the high volume of people that are on the derech. So Rabbi Yossi is looking for a place which is a little bit more private, where he could concentrate. He could contemplate.
He was looking to go off the derech.
Right, exactly. He wants to go off the derech. The derech is not the place. He wants to do his own thing.
I'm shocked.
Correct. You know, in certain religions, you know, especially in the East, when they want to contemplate, anybody know what that's called when they, you know, in the Eastern religions, when they go to contemplate something? Do you know what I'm referring to?
I mean meditation.
Meditation, exactly. So if you ever heard of Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, who died not long ago at a very young age, tragically, he wrote a book on Jewish meditation. And in a sense, this might be a good, he doesn't quote this particular verse, but this would be a good starting point for a book on Jewish meditation. Because Jewish meditation, which is prayer, requires absolute focus without distraction, and therefore Rabbi Yossi is looking for a place to pray. So where does he go into? Nichnasti, right? Milashon lichnos, or the root of this word is kenes. Chaf nun samach. Like, for example, if you remember Esther, if she hears the bad news about the decree of Haman, she says, Lech Knos. Knos means to gather together. What house is called a house of gathering?
Beit Knesset.
Beit Knesset, from the same word, Leknos, meaning it's an assembly. You know, in a kibbutz, for example, you have an assembly hall where the members of the kibbutz gather together to take a vote on something that's very important. Our house of assembly is a house where we assemble together as a congregation to pray. So that's called lichnos. Lichnos means to enter into some sort of area. The next word I want you to underline, because this is the key word for us this evening, he goes into a churva. So let's spend a minute or so explaining what a churva is. A churva is a house which has been left without any use. It's a churva. That's what it's called, a churva. For example, in the old city, there's a place called the churva. That synagogue was in a mess. It was a wreck until they redid it. Today it's the most beautiful synagogue probably in Jerusalem.
Churva means whore in Yiddish.
Okay, good. We'll get to that too. But first we're up to the word churva.
Start off with that.
Correct. It starts from this Gemara. Excellent. No, don't laugh at him. He's right.
Okay.
This whole discussion about who do you find in this churva is all about that particular profession, if you will. Okay, that some women unfortunately fall into. So nichnasti lechurva. He goes into this kind of an old haunted house, a dilapidated house. Now, a dilapidated house or churva is a place that people don't go into usually. They don't frequent there because it's very shaky. It's not very solid. Now, why isn't it solid? It could be it's ancient, and it's no longer, you know, it's no longer sturdy. That's what here in Jerusalem, you know, they have this whole movement. If you heard of it, Tama Shloshim V'Shmona, you'll see buildings that are being rebuilt. A lot of those buildings have. Oh, Sam is here. Good, excellent timing, Sam. It depends on which timing. If it's the 5:15 timing or the 5:30 timing, you know. If it's 5:30, then you're early, actually. So you can come back in 15 minutes. Okay, after all the jokes, we're talking about going into a churva. Now, again, why does Rabbi Yossi go into a churva? Why does he think it's an appropriate place to pray?
It's off the derech.
Okay, but what does it mean in English terms? You know,
It's quiet.
It's not frequented. There's no noise there. You know, if you go off the main road and you're looking for a quiet place to pray, then a churva is an excellent choice. And that's why he was very happy. The only thing is, a churva is very often dilapidated. And what might happen to a churva? Like, I never wanted. They took me to a place in Italy. Have you ever been to Pisa? So they took me under this tower. It was literally leaning, and I got very nervous because I thought it was going to fall on my head. Well, if you go into a churva, you got to be careful, because a churva could fall on your head. It's very dangerous. But anyway, he had no choice. He desperately needed a place to pray. Achas. This was one churva. When you say achas, it indicates that there were many others. Mi churvos Yerushalayim. This story apparently takes place after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Much of Yerushalayim had been razed to the ground, and Yerushalayim was now full of churvos. It was full of these dilapidated houses that were abandoned, and he chose one of them, probably the nearest one, lehispalel, and he went in there for tefillah, in order to pray. Now please, fellas, if we have time later, ask me what the word prayer really means, because in Hebrew, when you go back to the root of the word, which is palel, pei lamed lamed, you'll get an insight as to what Jewish prayer is all about, but that's not for now. So who comes to the, while Rabbi Yossi is praying, who comes to the door? None other than Bar Eliyahu, the great prophet Eliyahu. We believe that Eliyahu never really died, and he's still alive. He's going to be the harbinger of the ultimate redemption, but in this particular context, he's there waiting for Rabbi Yossi. And we're going to have to see, we have to wait patiently, to see exactly what message Eliyahu is bringing to Rabbi Yossi. Now, Eliyahu has what we call an appendix to his name. Do you know any people who have such a thing? You know, let's say, for example, if you were the star catcher for a baseball team, you know, they may call you Ronnie the Catcher. Well, what's the appendix to describe Eliyahu? He's called Zachur Latov. He's always remembered for the good. Now, the truth of the matter is that sometimes Eliyahu comes to castigate the Jewish people and rebuke them. So he's not Zachur Latov, he's giving us thumbs down. But more often than not, Eliyahu comes as a harbinger to tell us about something great that's going to happen, and that's called Zachur Latov. He should be remembered for all the good tidings that he brings to the people of Israel. Vishamar Li. Shamar Li literally means he protected me. Otherwise it means, as Rashi interprets it, himtinli, he waited for me. Shamar means when you're in a state of being frozen in a certain spot. You're a shomer. Shomer means you're a custodian. You have to watch something. So he was now the custodian. Al ha-petach. What's a petach?
Okay.
That's the opening. That's the door of the churva. And according to one text, which you'll see two words in parentheses, whenever you see something in parentheses, it means there's a question as to whether or not that's the proper text, the proper version. In this case, I believe that we should read these two words. Vehimtin li, and he waited for me. Ad until shesiyamti tfilosi. What does it mean, l'sayem? To complete. The word l'sayem, samach, yud, yud, mem, has two meanings to it. Either it means to designate something by drawing the outer boundaries of it, that's called the circumference, or it means to complete something. And when you finish a masechta, what do you make?
Siyum.
A siyum. Again, if you'll be here for the next 10 years, we'll hopefully make a siyum on masechta brachos. But right now we're up to daf gimel, which means we've covered 1.5 pages. That's not bad, since we meet once a week for an hour. In any event, so Eliyahu HaNavi is waiting for me until when? Until I complete my prayer. What does that indicate to you, Rabbi Osai? Can you derive two conclusions from the fact that... Yes?
One, you're not supposed to interrupt someone.
You're not supposed to?
Interrupt.
Excellent. He didn't want to interrupt him. Give him a chance to finish. But number two, he was eagerly waiting because he had something to tell Rabbi Yossi. Right? So he's waiting and waiting for Rabbi Yossi to complete his tefillah. Now, some people daven in 5 minutes. I suspect that Rabbi Yossi had a long davening. I don't know. I'm just trying to fill in the blanks here. And the Gemara is emphasizing the fact that Eliyahu had a great deal of patience, and he's waiting for Rabbi Yossi to finish his tefillah. Li'achar, after Shesiyamti, I finished my tefillah, tefillasi. Omar Li, Eliyahu turns to me and he says, Shalom Alecha Rebbe. Now that's really something respectful, but actually, who's greater, Eliyahu or Rabbi Yossi? Rabbi Yossi's a great man, but who's greater than Rabbi Yossi? Elio. Now, if there's a Rebbe and a Talmud, a rabbi and a student, who should really be the first one to greet the other one?
The student
should have taken. Here, in this case, Rabbi Yossi was waiting until Elio would actually introduce the shalom. Now, there are two interpretations of this. One interpretation is a little bit more cynical, and that is that Rabbi Yossi was very eager to see how Elio would greet him. So when Elio greeted him, Shalom Alecha Rabbi, and he called him his rabbi, no doubt Rabbi Yossi was very excited, he was very thrilled about that. You know, he called me a rabbi, that's great, I got smicha from Elio Anavi, that's a pretty good ordination. But the less cynical approach is to say that Rabbi Yossi was simply shaking in his bootstraps. You know, he was so overwhelmed with the fact that he is now encountering Elio. It's not somebody that you meet on a regular daily basis. This is the great Elio. He didn't know what to say. He was like frozen. And he was wondering if Elio was really there for him and would address him. So Elio says to him, Shalom Alecha Rabbi. Fia Marti Lo, so Rabbi Yossi testifies, because again, he's telling the story in first person. So I said to him, Shalom Alecha Rabbi Umori. Now notice that he adds one word, and that's out of a sense of respect. If you want to respect your Rebbe, then if he says to you, Shalom Alecha, you have to add another word. And in this case, normally a Rebbe would say to you, Shalom Alecha, how are you? You know, Shalom Aleichem. And you would add one word, you'd say, Shalom Aleichem Rebbe. But here, since Elio started by saying, Shalom Alecha Rebbe, that now Rabbi Yossi has to respect him by adding something to upgrade, to enhance the respect by saying, Shalom Alecha Rebbe, my Rabbi Umori. What's Umori?
My master.
Not really. I'll tell you what Mori means.
My teacher.
My guy, my teacher. What does it mean? Rebbe is a teacher, but Mori is a guide. A Rebbe can teach you abstract information, concepts. But a Mora is someone who teaches you the Derech. Again, and now Rabbi Yossi's back on the Derech, right? So he wants to mention to Elio, you are my Mora. And this is very important for the whole Braisa that we're learning today, because what Rabbi Yossi wants to know is what Elio should you, what words of guidance can you share with me so that I'll know how to lead my life? And that's called Rabbi Umori. Not just Rabbi in the sense that you taught me abstract knowledge, but in a practical sense, you've guided me in the right path. In the world of Shas, that's called a Mora Derech, the one who leads you on the road. Today, a lot of people in my age bracket are taking courses to become a Mora Derech. That's a guide. I don't know that it's such a lucrative business. In fact, I think the market is flooded. There are too many guides in the market, but a lot of people in my age bracket take the course. It's a 2-year course. It's even recognized as a master's degree by the universities here. The reason they take the course is not because they intend to be a Mora Derech, to actually go into the field professionally, but they enjoy the knowledge of it. They want to learn about Israel. And over the course of this 2 years, they go on hundreds, if not thousands, of hikes and visits. And they go to all sorts of archaeological digs, and they go to the Old City and to the Har HaBayit. They visit churches, which I'm not so excited about. You know, question whether you're allowed to go into a church. Not such a simple matter. But anyway, that's a course to become a Mora Derech. Mora Derech means a guide. Okay. V'amali. Here are the words of wisdom of Elio. He turns to me and he says the following. Bini, my son. That's a Lashon Chiba. Chiba means, it. You know, if you want to show someone how much you cherish him and how beloved he is, you call him my son. For what reason do you enter into this churva? Amarti lo lispalel. I went in here in order to pray. V'yomar li, and he responded to me. Hoyel chol lispalel baderech. You made a boo-boo. You should not have prayed in a churva, in this dilapidated, haunted house, but rather you should have prayed on the road itself. V'yomarti lo, and I said to him in self-defense, Miss Yare, what does Miss Yare mean? Yare, what does Yare mean?
Fear.
I was afraid. Miss Yare, you see? I was afraid, Shema perhaps, Yafsiku be, Ovrei Drachim, the Ovrei Drachim, who are the travelers on the path, on the road. Yafsikubi, what does Hefsek mean? An interruption, correct. I didn't want to be interrupted by the Ovrei Drachim, those who pass on the road. And again, you might homiletically say that the Ovrei Drachim are people who are not interested in tomorrow. If you know what I mean by tomorrow, it means the world to come. These are the Ovrei Drachim that are passing through life, and they're only focused on this world. And therefore, to them, my prayer is not important. So if I'm on the road and I'm praying, they're going to just sort of brush by me and interrupt me or distract me because they are Ovrei Drachim. They are just passing through this world. You know, eat, drink, and be merry. They don't have that view or that perspective that there's more to life than just being over death and passing through the road of life. They don't realize that and appreciate what tefillah, that we're here for something more eternal as prayer. So at this point, who seems to have the upper hand over here in this discussion? Who seems to be justified? Anybody?
Rabbi Yossi.
Rabbi Yossi, yeah. I mean, I have to pray, and I know that I'm going to be the interrupter, or at least I'm afraid I'm going to be interrupted by the passers-by. It makes sense, therefore, in my search to pray in a quiet area, a secluded area, I would go into a churva, the Amar Li, and Elio HaNavi, Zachur Latov, now tells Rabbi Yossi how you could have had your cake and eat it too. You could have reconciled two issues. Number one, the proper place to pray, and without being distracted. And number two, avoiding a churva. So again, what Elio HaNavi's goal is here is to illustrate and guide Rabbi Yossi that what he should have done, and if in the future, if you ever have this experience, this is what you have to do. You should actually pray on the derech, on the road. You should not go into a churva. But if you'll ask me, what about all the interruptions? The answer is hayalecha, you should have lispalel to pray tefila ktsara. Now tefila ktsara literally means an abridged tefila, and it's known as, let's see if I can find, no, it's somewhere here, but anyway, it's called Havinenu. What's Havinenu? Havinenu, if anybody happens to see a little red thing, a marker, I would write it on the board. Havinenu. Hey, if you want to write it down. Hey, Beis, Yud Nun, Nun Vav. Havinenu.
Give us understanding.
Havinenu is the first blessing of the middle section of our three times a day prayer. It's the first of what's called the Yud Gimel, the 13 supplications, otherwise known as Bakashot, that form the basic structure, the essence of any Amidah, any Shmon Esrei. The first one is called Havinenu, let us understand, otherwise known as Ata Chonen Li Adam Das. You familiar with that? God, please bestow upon me knowledge. So the first word in this prayer is Havinenu. And what Havinenu does is it really summarizes or abridges all the 13 middle supplications. So for example, here in the footnote, just for your own erudition, he quotes you the entire bracha of Havinenu. It goes like this. Havinenu Hashem Elokeinu Ladas Derechecha. God, give us the wisdom to know your ways. Umol eslavavenu liyirasecha. So if you have a Shmon Esrei, you'll see each one of these phrases is a summary of an entire blessing. V'tislach lanu, and forgive us. Urechakenu mikovenu. V'dashenu b'na'os hartzecha nefutzasenu. Again, we could go through this all if we had more time, but suffice it to say that this is a summary in a short form of all 13 middle supplications. And it ends with Baruch Atah Shomea Tefillah. Now the truth is, my friends, if I had to say Havinenu, it would take me 20 minutes to say Havinenu, because I would have to remember all these words. But apparently they had it printed up in one of these little things, you know, these little booklets. So he took it out of his wallet, and there it was, you know, printed form of Havinenu. In any event, I think what the halacha is that if you don't remember Havinenu, just simply in your own words, in any language, summarize the essence of the supplication. It's going to be a very short prayer. Now, there are many movements in Judaism other than Orthodox, and many of them are in favor of taking the prayer book and shortening it. That has nothing to do with that discussion here. We're not talking about a bridge sitter. We're talking about a case of a person who finds himself in a situation where he cannot pray with any sort of concentration. He's being interrupted and disturbed by so many things that's going on. He needs a short form of prayer. Some of the post-given decisors will tell you that if you're on a long plane ride, instead of praying the entire Shemoneh Esrei, you should pray Havinenu.
But you can't sit in the winter.
In the winter? I don't know about that.
You have the addition of...
Oh, I see what you're saying. The Saint Talamot to Levracha. Okay, that's a good point. I don't know, we'd have to take that under advisement. That's a good point. But in any event, I guess this was happening during the summer. It was an air-conditioned churva. And now you're on a plane, let's say, you know, and the stewardesses are getting very, very upset with you because they, you know, the red light is on, you know, say we have turbulence, and you're standing there, you know, for 10 minutes saying Shemoneh Esrei. So instead, you might say Havinenu. I'm not paskining for you. I'm not telling you that that's the ruling, but I'm just saying there are those who would maintain that that's the way to go. So look how Rabbi Yossi could have accomplished his goal without having to go into a churva. His goal was to pray in a way that he wouldn't be interrupted, and Elio recommended that he pray this short, abridged prayer, which is called Havinenu, and that's the obligation of prayer that he has to fulfill. He doesn't have to go beyond that, and in that way he won't be interrupted by people who are going by. And this is in order to avoid going into a churva. Okay, now Rav Yossi makes the following like postscripts to the story statement. He says, Be'osasha, at that moment in time, Lamadati mimeno, I derived from him, meaning from Elio Zokoleto, Shlosha Dvarim, three conclusions. Number one, Lamadati, I learned She'ein Nichnasim L'churva. It's a bad idea to go into a churva. Number two, Lamadati, I also derive the conclusion, Shemispalim Baderech, that you can and you're allowed to pray on the road. However, here's the punchline of it all. Lamadit Vilamadati, and I derive the conclusion, Shemispalim Baderech, one who has no choice but to pray on the road, Mispalil Tfilok Tsara. He should avail himself of this very short tefillah called Havinenu, and then he's okay. Now the story goes on. V'omar li b'ni, Elio continues. Ma kol shamata b'churva zu. There's a piece of the puzzle here that's missing. Maybe you could help me fit it in, because I don't know the answer to this. But somehow, Elio Anovi understood that Rabbi Yossi heard a voice inside this churva. How did Elio know that some sort of divine voice came out of the heavens while Rabbi Yossi was praying inside the churva? I can come up with only one answer, but maybe, gentlemen, you can come up with a better answer. Rashi doesn't say anything here.
He's a Navi, so he's used to hearing divine voices anyway.
Correct, that Elio himself heard the voice. He was just asking Rabbi Yossi to make sure that Rabbi Yossi got the message. I mean, sometimes, apparently, you could hear a divine voice, but it's so esoteric, you know, it's so abstract, and it's so divine, that a human being might not be able to discern the message. So Elio HaNavi wanted to confirm that Rabbi Yossi got the message. V'amarti lo. And I responded in the affirmative. Yes, shamati. I heard baskol. Baskol is a heavenly voice. Okay, some people mistakenly think that a baskol is something that it's like a chocolate soup that you put on ice cream. That's not what a baskol is. That's basko. Okay. Anyway, a baskol is a kol, which is a voice. Bas, which is a daughter of a voice, meaning it's not exactly a voice because it's something that only certain individuals hear and other people don't hear. You know, you have to have the capacity to perceive this voice. Sheminahemes. Now that's a very, very complicated word in modern Hebrew, and it means minahemes means it chirps, kiyona, as a dove. But here I have to tell you that we're not talking about a classic chirping of a dove. When a dove gives off a song, and there's entire discussion about this in the book of songs, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs of Shlomo. It's a very beautiful kind of a voice. But that wouldn't fit into Menahemes. Apparently, this Yono that we're talking about, this bird, we'll call it a pigeon of some sort, a dove, is in pain. Otherwise, the word Menahemes would make no sense, because the word Menahemes, which is an active verb, describes, again, its synonym would be Miyalelis. Miyalelis is to cry. For example, the Gemara Rosh Hashanah asks, what is the sound of the shofar? What does it symbolize? It symbolizes Yilula. Yilula means woeing or
wailing
or letting out a cry. So now there's a Yonah that's in pain. We're talking about a pigeon, I don't know, it got caught, its foot got caught in something or whatever it is. And the Yonah is letting out a cry, a wail of pain, of suffering. And the Baskol is now indicating that God is letting out this lamenting kind of woe, W-O-E. And where do we find that? And this is going to be the connection to the Gemara that we learned last week. Aaron, can you help me out here? Where do we find that? That the Baskol, which is the heavenly voice, is crying?
He roars.
Correct, that was the roaring of the lion. The roaring of the lion that we discussed last week that occurs every night, three times a night, at the end of the three Mishmarot. That is the idea that links us to this very complicated brisa, the story here, of the Baskol that Rabbi Yossi heard inside this churva. V'omeres. And she declares. Now this is the part where Rabbi Yossi comes through in the clutch, because he passes the test with flying colors. He understands exactly what is the content of this cry that comes from the heavens. What is the declaration? What is the message encoded in that yilula, in that cry? Oy, woe labanim. Woe it is to my children. And my children here is a symbolic reference to the people of Israel, because in the Pasuk in Dvarim, in the last of the five books, it says, Bonim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. You are children to your son. Or the Mishnah Novo says, Chavivin Yisrael Shenikroim Bonim l'Mokom. God says that you my people are Bonim. So when you talk about the suffering, that was the most painful experience that a parent could have, is when a child is in pain, to see the child in pain. I have a student who never lost a young boy, a 12-year-old boy, to that sickness. I don't want to mention it. And he said, he wakes up in the middle of the night, it's already years later, reminding himself of holding his son in that pain. So, Oyla Bonim, I cry out for my children, Shebavonoseihem, because of their sins, Hechravti as Basi, I had to destroy my house, Visarafti as Hecholi. Hecholi is the Holy of Holies. Within the Beit HaMikdash, you know, there are different sections, the holiest of which, where the Shulchan is, where the holy table is, that's inside the Hechal. The Hechal is the sanctuary inside. And I had to burn it, and it went up in smoke. Vehiglesim, and not only that, I had to exile my children, Lebein Ha'umot, amongst the nations of the world. So there are three terrible things that happen as a result of the sin of the people of Israel. Number one, the entire Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. But number two, the Hechal, which is the holiest of holies, that's where the Kodesh Kadoshim is, that went up in smoke. And number three, the people of Israel lost their rights, their justification for being in the land. They had to be exiled from the land.
What year was it?
Well, it depends which churban we're talking about. This is a reference to the second churban, the second Beis HaMikdash, which is 70 years before the Common Era.
70
BC, you would say?
No,
70 AD. 70 after the Common Era. Now, keep in mind, my friends, that this Gemara that we're learning now is very problematic from the perspective of a Jew, a great Jew who lived five centuries ago in the city of Tzfat. Do you know which Jew I have in mind?
The Arizal.
The Arizal says that the reason we go into exile is in order, again, I'll just mention it in passing, to redeem sparks of holiness that got trapped in different parts of the world. All this happened, this is a cataclysmic happening after the chait, the sin of Adam HaRishon. When man sinned, then although all of Kiddush, all of sanctity was focused, was concentrated in Gan Eden, but after his sin, and he was exiled from Gan Eden, the Kiddush, the sanctity in Gan Eden was spread throughout the world. It's called Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the utensils. This is Lurianic Kabbalah. You can read about it even in the secular book.
Kedusha, right?
And according to Arizal, we are going into Golus because we, in Golus, in the exile, we're able to enter into these contaminated places and isolate and locate those sparks of holiness that got trapped in contamination and free them. And bring them back to Eretz Yisrael, to the holy place. So the question is, and this was raised by a younger contemporary of the Arizal, also in the city of Tzfat, Rav Chaim ben Attar, who's otherwise known as the Orachaim HaKadosh, the Holy Orachaim. Many, many stories abound about him. Anyway, he asks the question, how is the Ari going to understand this Gemara that we're learning today? The Gemara says the reason why the people of Israel had to be exiled, Higlesim, Golus means exile, is because of Avonoseya, because of their sins. And further, he proved it from our prayers, because on a Musaf, the extra service, on any of the three holidays, we open up the middle part of the Musaf by saying, Mipnei chata'enu golinu me'artzenu, because of our sins we were sent into Golus. Well, the Arizal seems to have a whole different perspective on Golus, because he believes that the reason why we had to go into Golus, into the exile, it's all part of a divine plan to bring back these nitzotzos, these sparks of Kiddush, of sanctity. And the Orachaim HaKadosh does somersaults in the air in order to reconcile this principle that we see here with the principle of the Arizal. In any event, the Omar Li, Elio turns to me and he says the following, Chayecha v'chayei roshecha, or roshcha, by your life and the life of your head. Now, there's long discussions here in the commentaries about the double language here. Usually when you want to take an oath, then the language of an oath is b'chayai, in my life. I swear by my life, so to speak. Again, that has very deep meaning. It doesn't mean what you and I think it means. It has much more esoteric, mystical meaning.
And people in modern Hebrew say, casually.
They say casually. They don't realize that chayai has something to do with the divine being. It's much more esoteric and profound. But in any event, the double language here, chayecha, by your life, and chayei roshecha, in the life of your head, why the double language? But he says the following, Lo sha'azu bilvad omeriska. You're making a mistake if you think that sha'azu, because you remember, the question that was asked is, what did you hear at that moment? And when he, Rabbi Yossi, said, this is what I heard at that moment, it implies that it's a one-time thing. You know, that I was there to receive that baskel, that heavenly voice of crying. No, no, no. You're making a big mistake. It's not just at that moment, sha'azu, at that moment, bilvad, exclusively omer eskach, does the baskel say that. Ela b'chol yom v'yom, but rather on a daily basis, shalosh pa'amim, three times, which is at the end of each one of the mishmarot of the Laila, the segments of the Laila, omer eskach. Okay, then he goes on and says the following. Elio is going to teach us another important lesson. V'lo zo bilvad, and not only does God cry during the Shagat Aryeh, that lions roar three times a night on a daily basis, but Ella b'sha'ah sheYisrael nichnasim lebatei knesiot lebatei midrashot. Whenever, any hour in which, any time in which the Jewish people enter into the synagogues or the houses of study. Now, the assumption here is that although a certain location was designated for study, that's called Medrash. Medrash means study. Nevertheless, it's also got another function. That's not its primary, but its secondary function is it serves as a house of prayer. And again, this is a long discussion later on the eighth page of Masechet Brachos, Are you allowed to take a base medrash, which is exclusively dedicated for study, and convert it into a house of worship? You know, today, you know, we don't even blink about it. You know, we go into a base medrash and we start praying and we have a minyan and so forth. Back in the day, it wasn't a simple matter. This Gemara seems to reflect the final conclusion of that sugya later on in Daf Chet, that a Beit HaMedrash is also appropriate for prayer. At what moment in time does Almighty God break out, so to speak, in tears? V'onim Yehesh Mei HaGadol Mevorach. In Kaddish, the apex of Kaddish is Yehesh Mei Rabbah. Here, instead of the word Rabbah, it says Gadol. Rabbah is in Aramaic, and Gadol is in Hebrew. So this Brisa is more interested in the Hebrew translation of Yehesh Mei Rabbah. When the people of Israel say Yehesh Mei Rabbah, or Yishma Gadol, Mivorach, it should be praised and glorified. When we are glorifying the great name of God, where would be the appropriate place for us to do so? Not in a synagogue, not in a house of worship. That's the appropriate place today, because we live in a period post Churban, post the destruction. The real place, the location on the face of the earth for praising and glorifying God would be in His, capital H, His home. In HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God hears our Yehesh Mei Rabbah, Minanea Rosho. Right, you remember you take on the Dalet Minim on Sukkahs, and what do you do with them? Any know what that's called?
Tnufa.
Nanuim, it's called. And Tnufa is a biblical phrase for the Beis HaMikdash when they did Kodshim, Tnufa Shlomim. But we're not talking about Tnufa in the Beis HaMikdash. I'm talking about you and I. When we take the lulav, what do we do with the lulav? We shake it, right? That's called shaking. Minanea, Nanuim. Nanuim means shaking. And Nanuim means that God shook His head. Now, why is God shaking His head? There are one or two interpretations. Either He's shaking His head out of pain. Like, have you ever seen someone in pain? His whole body starts shaking. You can see his head shaking. Otherwise, it could be Minanea means He's nodding a nod of approval. So either this is an expression of God's suffering. Again, kaviyachol, everything is in human terms. Or it means that God nods a nod of approval about this praise, that this is a great glorification of God's name. The Omer, but then God makes the following statement, which is a little bit more sad, a little bit more despairing. Ashrei HaMelech, you know when the king is fortunate? Shemekalsin, Kilus, that's Kuf, Lamed, Yud, Samach, means to praise. Shemekalsin, meaning we're turning Kilus into a verb. Mekalsim also, Bebeso, in his house, kach, in that way. His house means in the king's palace. Apparently, back in the day of kingship, the various officers in the kingship would surround the palace, and they would sing the praises to the king. You know, long live the king, our great lord, our great king. So in a sense, says this statement of God, God is declaring that the most appropriate place in the ideal form of glorification of my name would have been in the Beit HaMikdash. However, we have no Beit HaMikdash. It's completely destroyed. So the best we can hope for is Kilus, is this glorification of God's name in something that is a substitute for the Beit HaMikdash, and that's the house of prayer. Then God cries another cry, also for Himself. Malo la'av, woe to a father, shehigla es banav, who had to send his own sons into exile. Like sometimes a king, if his son is really misbehaving, or as you say, Zach, off the derech, you have to send him into exile. But how sad it is for a father, and here God is referring to Himself in third person, who has to send his own sons into Golus. V'oylehem lebanim, and woe, my pain for the children themselves, shegolu, that they were exiled, me'al shulchan, from the table of avim, of their father. Now, again, the word table, shulchan, is a symbolic reference to what? What is the Shulchan with a capital T-H-E?
the base of Mikdash
in the Heichal, correct? That was the Shulchan on which you remember the Lechem Aponim, you know, the showbread was kept. So when the Beis HaMikdash was there, the Kohanim used to put for every week they would put in the showbread on this table, and then at the end of the week they would take it out, and then they would divide it up amongst the Kohanim who were on duty in that watch, and they would eat it in Kiddush and Tara in a state of sanctity. So now let's try to figure out, why is Eliyahu HaNavi so object? Why does he object so strongly to Rabbi Yossi going into a churva? Tanu Rabbana, we learned in a Braisa. Tanu means we learned, Rabbana the rabbi. So the rabbis taught us in a Braisa. So we're talking about Tanaic literature at the time of the Mishnah. Mipnei Shlosha Dvarim, because of three different things. Ein Nichnasim. Did I go too fast or too slow?
No, I'm just wondering, there's no difference between Tanya, like in terms of where the source is between Tanya and...
Usually Tanya is the first Braisa. Tanu Rabbanan would be an addendum or an embellishment of the Braisa that's already quoted. But both Tanya, we learned in a Braisa, and Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught us in a Braisa, mean the same thing. So for our purposes, if you would walk into yeshiva and ask your average yeshiva student, what's the difference between Tanya and Tanu Rabbanan, he'll look at you like you're, you know what I mean? Like there's no difference. Mipnei Shlosha Dvar, for three reasons, Ein Nichnasim L'Churva. We don't go into a Churva. We're now on the last line on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph. First, Mipnei Chashad. Chashad means you're going to, it's suspicious. And as your name is Weinberg?
Feinberg.
Okay, I'm sorry. Leave him alone. Don't bother him. Anyway, as he says, Mr. Weinberg said before, who usually hangs out in a churva, in this private area that's off to the side? It's a woman of ill repute. So that's called chashad. Chashad means suspicion. You don't want people to suspect you that you're looking for, okay, your interpretation of the word churva. Number two, mipnei amapolis. Mapolis means an avalanche, and something falls on your head, because if this churva is dilapidated, that's why it was left, what word am I looking for? Alone, what's the word?
Abandoned.
What'd it say?
Abandoned.
Abandoned, excellent. I like that word, abandoned. So why was this churva abandoned? Apparently, not only is it shaky, but it might fall any minute. And thirdly, mipnei amazikim. Now, the mazikim means those forces that are out there to destroy you. Again, you know, the haunted house is very dangerous.
Those are like the shadim that like destroy houses, basically, that said that basically that's what you don't go into.
Shadim are basically the forces of evil that attack you when you're alone. The worst thing from a Torah perspective is being alone. Loneliness and being alone is not a good thing, because when you're alone, all sorts of terrible things happen.
That's why the halacha is you can go into a ruin if you're with someone else.
Correct. Now, if Rabbi Yossi would have been with a buddy, and he wouldn't have gone in alone, the chances are he would have been all right, at least from the perspective of Mazikim. Again, he might be still in danger of a mapolis. So the Gemara is going to go through all these three reasons and show you why you need each one of the three reasons.
And the buddy can't be a woman of ill repute, right?
Not only that, it can't be another man if that man also visits a house of ill repute. Do you follow me?
Yeah, yeah.
So you got to choose your buddy. You know, if he's an upstanding guy, it doesn't matter whether he wears a tie or a $500 suit. It matters whether he's a kosher, meaning he has the reputation of being a more saintly individual. But if he's on the lower end of the echelon and you're going in with him, so you know you're both online, maybe to see the same person, or maybe there's more than one woman there. I don't know.
What about the concept of Hikbo de Dut in Breslau?
I don't know. I don't know exactly.
That's usually in the forest.
I think prayer is the only power and the only force on the face of the universe that can protect you from mazikim if you're alone. And again, mazikim come in different forms and different shapes. You know, I gave a lecture here on Saturday, on Shabbos, about the dangers of the internet. So I said, look, you know, you can't do away with the... Everybody has to have access to the internet, perhaps. I mean, eventually, for sure. There was a famous Aguda convention. You heard of the Aguda movement?
Yeah.
The Ultra-Orthodox? So they came out with a proclamation that you're not allowed to use the internet. the afternoon of that proclamation, when they were announcing all the programs of the Aguda of the next few months, they ended the announcement by saying, and check out our website on the internet. It was a little bit funny, you know what I'm saying? They just finished telling us you're not allowed to use the internet.
To the Aguda website, because they have lectures and stuff like that.
Yes, a wealth of good stuff. So anyway, so on, at this lecture,
you can't have you on the internet, else it's remote internet, right?
I think it says on the website.
So I tried to present a few possible recommendations, because the internet is what you call a churva. What do I mean to say? You know, the internet is full of things of ill repute. And even if you're not looking for them, they like pop up on the screen, whether you like it or not. So that I suggested that maybe, again, it's a little bit naive on my part, but I suggest that maybe you should situate your computer, again, don't ask me about laptops, but make sure your computer's in a public area. Because when you're alone, the mazikim get to you, you know, they get the best of you. But at least if it's in your office in a public place, then people are monitoring, they're worried about what you're looking at, so you might be inhibited, you know, so the power of the mazikin is a little bit. Anyway, so we have, who can answer this quiz question? Who can give me, without looking in the Gemara, three reasons why you should not go into a churva?
Collapse.
Number one, it might collapse. Number two, it might be very suspicious. You know, people go in there for not the most kosher reasons.
It may cost too much money.
Right, cost you too much money. And number three, because of mazikim. You know, they were very, it's a haunted house. Okay. So now Gemara wants to understand, why do we need all three reasons? So for example, mipnei achashad, the first reason on your list is because people will suspect him of doing something not so on the up. Vitepukle, oh, these are two words that if you're beginning in Gemara, you have to memorize them, because they're all over the show. It's almost on every other page in Shas. Vitepukle, you should derive it from. Tepuk means to go out. You can derive it when you derive something from. It's like a lemon, you squeeze out the juice of the lemon. Lay it. You can derive the same conclusion. Don't go into a churva. Mipnei amapolis. A churva is a dangerous place. You don't want to put your life into danger. You're not allowed to put your life into danger. Don't ask me about extreme sports, and please don't ask me about skiing. It's a very sensitive issue. I lost the Talmud to skiing. Mm-hmm. I lost the Talmud on the first time he went skiing. So skiing is a very sensitive issue for me. And when I was in the army here in Israel, they wanted me to do certain things in the army. I don't know, I was 34 years old when I got to the Israeli army. Today they don't even take you at that age. But in those days they were desperate, so they took me. And they asked me to do a few dangerous things. I said, you got to find a... So, you know, we might court-martial you. I said, I'm not afraid of court-martial. The halacha says you're not allowed to go into a churva because it's dangerous. So don't send me into a dangerous place. Now, how can you be in the Israeli army and not go into a dangerous place? You know what I'm saying? Like, so at the end, they sent me to a lecturer's unit. That was after 6 weeks of packaging, you know, my note krav. Anyway, so the tape of you already told me I'm not allowed to go into a churva because it's a dangerous place. Why do you have to add to that the fact that this chashad?
And I have a question. Sorry. So, but wouldn't someone else have to go into the churva then? So wouldn't it just be designating it for...
What do you mean by someone else? You mean somebody who's there to break down
another yid is in the army. Like why is it... It's that,
you know, wait, I'm lost. Sam, are you talking about the army? Or
I'm talking about the army.
Okay, the army, right.
So, it's like Shabbos. Like, you can't just be, another yid. Like, yeah, I can't pick up this phone right now. But,
right. That's how I'm telling you. That my actions cannot be universalized, you know.
Oh, I see.
I didn't live up to the categorical imperative of Immanuel Kant, you know.
I got it.
Thanks. You can't be an Israeli, or in any army in the world, and say, well, I'm not going to do it because it's dangerous.
Yeah,
you know, it's just... this was just to wake you up from sleep, you know.
Yeah.
All right. So again, Rabosai, here's the question: why do we need the logic of chashad? You know, that people suspect you of going into a place with a woman, when you already have another reason, a very good reason, why you're not allowed to go in there, because it's dangerous. The whole thing might collapse on your head. It's a dilapidated structure. So we're turning now to Daf Gimel Amid Beis. So we could break out a bottle of whiskey. Now we're on a new page. This is good. You know, we finished the page. Bechadati. The Gemara says the following: that very often you'll find that the people in construction, like the construction workers, when they build a house, they do a good job, and then over the course of a long period of time, it becomes weaker. You know, the weather and all the conditions, you know, the natural conditions do their job, and eventually, you know, you have a build. That's what they do here, as I mentioned to you before. They're taking these old buildings that might collapse, and they're restructuring them. But charite is a very strange kind of phenomenon. Charite means a new structure. A new structure. You see the tuf at the end of the word charite, the next to the last letter? So that is a replacement in Aramaic. A replacement for a shin is very often a tuf. So take out the word, the letter tuf, and put it instead of shin, and it means bichadashim, right? Because, you know, the plural of Yud Mem in Hebrew becomes Yud at the end of a word in Aramaic. A lot of great similarities between Aramaic and Hebrew. Here's one example. It means Chadashim. So we're talking about a new Churva. Now, what's a new Churva? The answer is that the construction workers did not follow apparently very good plans of the engineer or of the architect, and it was already from its very beginning, it was a shaky kind of structure. Now, When it comes to a new structure, because it's a little bit shaky, and let's say the department of what would we call the department of engineering or construction in the municipality, they decided that this is not passed all the tests, all the requirements. So there has to be some movement in the framework. But right now, it's not about to fall. Eventually, it's going to fall because it wasn't constructed properly according to all the rules. Nevertheless, no one's going in there. No one's going in there except for whom? You guessed it, a woman of ill repute. That's where she would be. So now, on the level of Mapolis, since it's a relatively new structure, we don't expect it to fall in the very near future. So there's no hesitation here, inhibition, because of the Mapolis aspect. But nevertheless, it's already become a great place for these women to hang out here. So there's already a chashad. Now the Gemara asks another question. Why did you need the extra logic of chashad, meaning we suspect him of doing something not kosher, in the case of a churva chadosh? A chadati means it's a brand new churva. Typically, I could derive the conclusion they shouldn't go in there, even though it's new and it's not about to fall, mishum mazikim, because of these dangers that lurk in a secluded, abandoned place. So since this building, this structure is abandoned, again, it's not about to fall, and again, you shouldn't go in there, obviously, because people will suspect you, but the Gemara asks, forget about suspicion, even without suspicion, we have to worry about mazikim. So the Gemara answers, betray. There are two people. He's going in not alone, but with someone else. The mazikim are not usually out there to attack you if you're with someone else. So the Gemara asks, e betray, if we're talking about a case with the two people, chashad nami leka. Right, this is based on a Gemara at the end of Kiddushin, and if you want to research this, I wrote an article on this topic, that if two men are alone with one woman, then each one inhibits the other one, and we're not afraid that he might have a relationship with this woman. So you're telling me this chashad, people suspect him of going in order to have a relationship with this woman, but he's going in with his buddy. How do I know he's going in with his buddy? Because otherwise there'd be a problem with mazikin. So we've solved the problem of mapolis. It's a brand new kind of structure. We've solved the problem of mazikin because he went in with his friend. So the Gemara asks, haven't you also at the same time solved the problem of chashad? So if Rabbi Yossi would have gone into a new kind of a churva with another buddy, it would have been fine. The Gemara answers, betray ubipritze. These two fellows are pritze. Pritze means parutz. Parutz is someone, like if you have a fence and there's a hole in the fence, it's called parutz. It's open. So normally when you put up a fence, it's solid and it keeps out things that shouldn't be going in there. It's a kind of protection. But if it's parutz, you know, there's a big hole, a gaping hole in it. So parutzim idiomatically refers to people who are not held back, they're not inhibited by all the fences that society puts up to keep men and women separated. They're parutzim. So if you have ksherim, if it's two ksherim going into a churva, that would be okay. So according to this Gemara, if two ksherim, you know, two yeshiva guys, would go into a brand new churva.
Ksherim means people that operate.
Kesher being kosher, meaning that they're not suspect, you know, they're not suspicious of, we don't suspect them of pritzus. Pritzus means to break down the moral inhibitions. So if they're not pritzim, they're called ksherim. Ksherim means those who are upstanding citizens. And one person, even if the Yetzirah would get the best of him and he would attempt him, but he'd be embarrassed in front of his friend because his friend doesn't, you know, doesn't respect some of that kind of immoral behavior. So if he's there with two people, then you can solve all three problems of going into a churva. Number one, it's a brand new churva. It's not about to fall, so there's no mapolis. Number two, he's with a buddy, so there's no mazikin issue. Number three, his buddy is a kosher. He's someone reliable. So it's inhibited, and therefore there's no chashad, there's no suspicions.
But two people who are of low moral character aren't going to reflect and say, oh, we shouldn't enter this chuva because we're of low moral character. They're going to do it anyway.
No, because they're going to because they want to enjoy life. You understand what I'm saying? If they're low character, you know, you can bet your bottom dollar why they're going into this churva. I mean, again, I don't want to say it explicitly.
They can't be poor. So.
Again, when Mr. Weinberg said bottom dollar, it's going to cost you a lot of money, but they don't mind. They're prutzim. You know, a parents will spend. The Gemara has a story, by the way, in the Masechta Avodah Zarah about a certain individual who never missed up with any prostitute in the world. And he found out that there was a prostitute on the other side of the world. He gathered together an enormous sum of money in order to visit that prostitute. The Gemara is not embarrassed about telling such a story. That person is the paradigm of Baal Tshuva. At the end of the day, he did Tshuva before he had relations with this woman.
In our Musar class, it was said in, I think, Salanter's writing.
Yeah, we read about it in one of the Musa classes that we had.
Who is it?
What was his name?
It's one of the Rabbi Eliezer's, I thought.
It'll come to me in a second. Anyway, it's an Avodah Zarah, page 17. But what's his name was... it's at the tip of my tongue.
Wasn't it one of the Rabbi Eliezer's that was the Rabbi?
Oh, yeah, Ben Durdaya. You're right. Elazar Ben Durdaya. You're right. Elazar Ben Durdaya. At the end of the day, he did shuv. How are we doing on the clock? Oh, we're not doing great. So let me just add 5 more minutes and we'll call it a day. The Gemara asks the following question. Mipnei HaMapolis, why do you have to add the danger element? Typically, let's derive it, meaning the prohibition of going into this churva, Mishum Chashad Umazikim. He's going into a churva, this chashad, people suspect him of low behavior. Number two, he'll be attacked by Mazikim. So the Gemara says, betray, Ukshere. They're two people that are going into the churva, and they're both ksherim, right? They're upstanding, morally upstanding. So they're inhibited, and we don't have to worry neither about chashad, nor do we have to worry about mazikin. But we do have to worry about mapolis. It might fall down. Mipnei mazikin, you tell me there's a third reason for not going into a churva, because of the mazikin. V'tepukle, why not derive that conclusion? Mipnei chashad umapolis. We already have two other good reasons why you should avoid frequenting a churva. So the Gemara answers, it's churva charity. It's a new churva, and therefore there's no mapolis issue. We're not afraid it'll fall. There's a problem of chashad. There's no problem of chashad. Why? Betray ubiksheri. The two ksherim that are going in together. Each one inhibits the other person. We're not afraid that they'll do anything immoral. So Gemara says, "E betray if they're two people, mazikim nami leka. There shouldn't even be a problem with mazikim because mazikim really attack you when you're alone. But here you're with a friend." And the Gemara answers, "This is a breakthrough answer. Bim koman, you went into their place. No, it's the churva is where these mazikim hang out." So if you're two people walking down the street or even on a dark alleyway, then we say that the mazikin are not going to chep with, they're not going to bother you. But if you're going into Makomam, this is the place where the mazikim lurk, that's where they hang out. You know, it's like, I think of the bats. You know what I mean by bats? You know, they go into these caves and stuff. You never saw Batman, did you? No?
I was in one of the Dead Sea Scroll caves.
Nobody here saw Batman.
I saw Batman.
Oh, So at least it's one other person who admits that he saw Batman. There's so when I saw Batman, you know, they in the first Batman, they tell you how he, you know, his parents, the whole story. Anyway, you remember the bats? They just fly. So those bats are Mazikim. And the Mazikim go into these caves that are full of bats. The Eboy is saying, and with this we'll conclude, the Gemara offers another answer. You remember last week we had the Eboyus, and if you want, Amar will tell you this. Whenever the Gemara wants to offer you an alternative answer to a question, it uses the term the Eboyus Amar. Li'olam bechad. It's really, in truth, one individual. Ubechurva chadati. And he's going into a brand new churva. And here there's going to be a problem of Mazikim because he's alone. But there's no problem of Mapoles because it's new. It's not going to fall imminently. Nor is there a problem of Chashada that maybe he's going in there to do something immoral. Why? And the answer is Dekoy Bidavra, that this Churva is located out in the wild, out in the at the end of the fields or at the end of the in the desert area. It's outside the urban centers. The Hassam, in a place that outside the urban centers, mishum chashad leka. You won't be suspected of going there for finding a woman. The ha'isha, because a woman, bedavra lo shchicha. Lo shchicha means she's not generally found out there in the davra. In other words, a woman wants to jack up her her clientele. You know, she just wants the great numbers of clientele because each client pays some bucks. So she wants to be located where? Where would she have more of a chance of getting clientele? In the city center. You know, she doesn't want to go out to the end of the fields. You know, But on the other hand, on the contrary, because it's a place which is not frequented by people, it's not inhabited, it's beyond the urban, you know, the boundaries of the urban center, that's exactly where the Mazikin want to get a hold of you. So again, even though it's a churva chadati, it's relatively new, which means you don't have to worry about it falling on top of you. And number two, there's no chashad because it's outside the urban centers, no one goes there to find a woman. But nevertheless, there is an issue of mazikim because it's exactly there that the mazikim want to get a hold of you in a private area. So my friends, here's where we're going to stop. If somebody can make a note of Tanur Rabbanan, this is where we're up to another brisa, and the Gemara now is going to offer the possibility that we break up the night not into three parts, but into four segments, and that's what we're going to research next week. If you can add your number or your email or both on this list. I don't know if it went around. If it did, maybe Sam, you could add yours. And then if there's any question or issue about, you know, until now I've been relying on my right arm. That's Jackie. Jackie's been my right arm. And he's been doing a great job.